Hello and welcome to the CFO Playbook podcast. I'm David, I'm a journalist and broadcaster, and I cover technology and business with a special interest in startups. And here on CFO Playbook, we get under the skin of how world-class finance leaders from across various industries set goals, manage teams, leverage technology, plan for the future, and much, much more. In today's episode, we speak with the CFO and COO of a company which has the broadest possible view of what it takes to bring sustainable energy to our homes.
We've had it right from the start, but it's a very basic concept, but basically is you maintain concentration limits in your investments. So market, you know, not too heavy into any one single market in case anything changes. Technology, again, you mix it up with offshore wind, onshore wind, solar, battery storage, mix it up in the different markets again. So you have a lot of diversification. And finally, the stage of life. So you have a lot more risks in an early stage development asset that hasn't yet got its planning or its land or its grid. You know, a government policy might change something that would delay or even stop that versus an operational project that's already up and running. Governments typically don't like to mess with assets that are already up and running because the capital's already in and there would be a backlash. So basically, concentration limits and make sure you're in lots of different markets with lots of different asset classes at lots of different stages.
If you're listening to CFO Playbook for the first time, then welcome. Every month, we bring you exclusive interviews and insights from world-class finance leaders. So if you like what you hear today, then well, make sure you subscribe. Have a listen back through our extensive back catalogue too. And don't be afraid to get in touch, as many of you do. Let us know what or who you'd like us to speak to in the future. Right. On with today's show.
This episode of the CFO Playbook is brought to you by Soldo. Thousands of businesses from small to large corporations, including Mercedes-Benz, Sony, and Get Your Guide, use Soldo to make their business spending simple and efficient. To find out more or to book a demo, visit soldo.com.
CFO and COO at renewable energy specialist NTR, Marie Joyce has a wealth of experience turning ambitions around sustainable energy transition into reality. Prior to joining NTR in 2004, Marie worked at Arthur Andersen as Audit and Corporate Finance Manager and Elan as Senior Director of Strategic Planning. With under and postgraduate degrees from University of Galway and UCD, she is a Fellow of Chartered Accountants Ireland. Marie, great to meet you. Thank you for joining us on CFO Playbook podcast.
You too, David. Nice to meet you.
Whereabouts are you joining us from today?
I am joining you from the Sandford Industrial Estate in Dublin, Ireland.
Oh, I love speaking to people on industrial estates. Thank you for tuning in. But I guess just over your shoulder there, a hint to the conversation that we'll be having today and maybe fitting for being on an industrial estate, there is a big piece of engineering that we're going to be talking a little bit closer to in a moment. But I'm really looking forward to hearing about your work as a CFO in the sustainable energy industry. Let's begin by talking about your current employer, NTR. Now, NTR may not be a household name for many, but its power is certainly beginning to be felt in a growing number of homes across Western Europe and the Nordics. Infrastructure is very much in NTR's DNA. For its first 20 years, it was exclusively a national toll road investor and operator, constructing Ireland's first ever toll bridge in the late 1970s. And then in the 80s and 90s, the M50 Westlink crossings over the River Liffey in Dublin, which I'm sure many of our Irish listeners know all too well. And then just as the millennium was ticking over, NTR changed tack and began on a strategic journey of investments in sustainable infrastructure and energy projects across Europe and across the US. Marie, that's the backstory, which I'm sure you know all too well, but bring us up to date. What does NTR do today?
Well, today NTR is an investor in and asset manager of European clean energy funds. We operate wind, solar and energy storage assets across over 60 locations in Europe. We have 1.8 billion euros of assets under management. The funds we raise through three investment funds. And the source of funding of those investment funds is institutional capital, so pension funds, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, that type of capital.
So, there's a few different things in there. You invest, construct and operate as well. That strikes me as kind of different parts of the business there, very different parts of the business.
There's three actually separate parts of the business. There's the investment team who acquire the assets and project finance the assets or get the debt into the assets. Then we've got a construction and operations team who actually constructs them, so engineers and operate them. And then we have the finance and operations team, which is my team, which once they're constructed, we work with the ops team to manage them over the course of their lives.
Okay. So does NTR, I mean, we alluded in the intro there about NTR's background, National Toll Roads, and then how there was this change around about the millennium, this kind of change of direction almost. What? How do you articulate what NTR's mission is right now?
Our mission is to advance the cause of sustainable infrastructure, really. We've always been an infrastructure. So NTR's been around for almost 50 years. Started with toll roads, which wasn't necessarily the sustainable side, but thereafter we invested in wind, solar, ethanol, recycling. It was always had a sustainability angle to it. So today we're purely sustainable infrastructure, but our beginnings were sustainable nearly right from the start.
Now, I'll let you into a secret, Marie, because when I originally wrote the introduction, I wrote at the coalface of the energy transition before I very quickly realised how inappropriate a metaphor that was going to be for the kind of decarbonised conversation that we're having today. But whether you're at the coalface or the cutting edge of the industry, you have a really interesting dual role at NTR now as CFO and COO. So tell me a bit about what that dual role really means for you. Is it a case of consciously splitting your time between wearing those two hats, or do they kind of complement one another?
You could say either the cutting edge of the wind turbine blade.
very good.
My role is definitely mingled rather than split. It's actually quite common in the private capital space where you have a small number of people managing a couple of billion euro in investment funds. They tend to be small teams. We do have a lot of that CFO-COO combination. The CFO has three aspects. First of all, product design. So what do the investment funds look like? What technologies? What markets? How long are we investing in the assets for? And then all the legal and tax structuring around that. Then there's the acquisitions themselves. So the review of the investment bids and the acquisitions and the oversight of deal completion. And then the normal sort of CFO stuff, which would be governance, risk and financial management of the funds and the underlying investments. And that includes investor reporting and investor relations. So that's this kind of CFO side, and it is a bit mingled with the COO side. So the COO side then is legal, HR, PR, information security, digital transformation, and just the general running of the office.
Oh my word. I mean, I know this is the CFO playbook, but the number of different hats you have to wear as a COO there as well, from how you just mentioned it there, that blows my mind a little bit. Are there any... You mentioned it's not uncommon, particularly in investment management, to have that dual role. Are there any challenges that the dual role brings, or do you see that there are benefits that come with the kind of dual oversight of the operations side as well as on the finance side?
I definitely think more benefits than challenges. Now, it is quite broad, and the sheer scale of the number of things that could be bouncing from 1 hour to the next is quite... It's quite, you know, it's quite deep. You know, I could be negotiating with investors in Italy, start of the day, could review an investment proposition in France. I could be hiring an asset manager in Sweden, assessing which ERP system to implement, which we're currently doing, to sorting out the overflow car parking arrangements for the office. So it can be as diverse as that. But like, there's a great team here. We all work hand in glove together. So definitely more complementary.
Now, you've been at NTR for a little while, politely, 20 years across various parts of the business. What was your journey going into NTR, and what's been your journey through it to where you are now?
Well, my background was in M&A and transformation. So in Anderson, which you mentioned, I did lots of the acquisitions in Ireland at the time. A lot of American companies were coming in and investing in Irish companies. So I did a lot of those, did a lot of IPOs. But I moved to Elan. Elan was a biotech. It was actually Ireland's largest company at the time. And I led a lot of acquisition processes in the early days there. But then the share price collapsed from $60 to $1, and the company had to be rapidly transformed. So I ended up in a major restructuring program, and I actually led $1.1 billion worth of pharmaceutical product sales in the US. So once we got Elan back on its feet, it got quite stable. I started looking again for a company that had high growth internationally. I liked the diverseness nature of the different businesses. And Intior was that such company. It was in Ireland at the time, headquartered out of Dublin here, actually in Sandyford, and had lots of businesses in Ireland, UK and the US. Because when I joined Intior, it was very different to what it is today. It was a typical conglomerate. It was 5,000 people, subsidiaries in Ireland, the UK, US. It was in toll roads. It was in wastewater treatment, ethanol, recycling, broadband, wind, solar, battery storage. You know, it was a very diverse company. And I started as finance director of a startup within Intior called Irish Broadband. It was a novel wireless broadband technology at the time. In 2004, we had to persuade people that broadband was actually a good thing. We were kind of selling broadband at the time. And that's where I cut my teeth a little bit on the operations side, because we went from 300 customers when I joined to 50,000 customers. So I ended up involved in a bit of sales because we needed to make sure we're hitting our targets, and customer service, because churn is a big thing in telco and trying not to lose our customers. So that's where I started with Intior. And I went on from there to be finance director of our solar development company in, based out of London. And that was signing up deals basically across Europe, which would use the technology that Intior was developing at the time called concentrated solar power. And unfortunately, what happened with that technology, which was based out of Arizona in the US, the Chinese government backed solar PD, which meant that CSP, concentrated solar power, was no longer going to be economical. So we quickly wound that up. We saw the writing on the wall, thankfully. And as part of that, then I moved into more of a group role. I moved back into HQ to restructure both the solar businesses. And then that was 2010 with the global financial crisis. So we, a lot of our businesses, you know, were hungry for cash because they were all high growth businesses. The markets weren't great. So we restructured, reorganized both head office here in Dublin and some of those subsidiaries. My role prior to then, my current role as CFO, was group commercial director, whereby we disposed of certain of our US assets. It was about 2013, 2014. We had great assets in the US in terms of wind, ethanol. So we sold out really at a high on those assets. We had a lot of money then left in the group. So at that point in time, then I was appointed group CFO, and myself and the CEO did a major restructuring of the company. And again, Intior has always been so different in all the years that I've been with it. But what we did in 2015 was that we actually demerged the company. We pulled it into two, and we put what we called all the legacy assets into a wind-up vehicle, which still exists today, but it was winding out of all the remaining legacy assets. And the company that is Intior today is the renewable, the pure renewable arm. So what we did was we returned about $250 million to investors, sort of took it private, and then followed this pure renewable fund management strategy.
That's quite a journey you've been on. And you mentioned the conglomerate nature of Intior when you joined it 20 years ago. And I can imagine in 2004, 2005, when the world, well, maybe certain parts of it, I can speak for the UK, I can't speak for Ireland quite so closely back then, but there's almost a convincing job, almost a sales job that needs to be done that, hey, this World Wide Web thing, it's going to be important to your future. You know, these are pre-smartphone days, really. But the rate at which that industry was moving at the time, and you mentioned the growth in customers and, you know, everything from customer support as well as to the technology stack having to evolve that quickly. And then all the other parts of the business that you've moved through there as well. I wonder how important, you mentioned the broad hat that you wear now, both as CFO and as COO. That knowledge inside out from front office to back office of the business, you've kicked all of the tires in that car park. That must be a real benefit and a real solace, comfort in a way, when it comes to having operational as well as financial oversight over what NTR is today.
Well, exactly. I think having the combined role means that I was able to, it sounds a bit cliche, but follow the money. I know what worked well for us, which investments worked well, where we made money, where we had potential to make more money, but also aligned with the risk. So the risk reward of various investments into different asset classes and different countries. I had that kind of holistic view of risk and reward, I guess, as we looked at the different strategies and where we go next.
Now, the world's changed in 20 years that you've been there in particular. Obviously, NTR's changed. The world around it has changed. And in particular, I guess the acknowledgement of climate change and the world's, on the whole at least, response to it and now the momentum behind energy transition. You alluded to it there somewhat. I'd like to go into a little bit more detail, perhaps, about how NTR's strategy has changed in that time. And specifically, you mentioned your partnership with the CEO of the company at various times. What your role as the CFO has played in informing and executing on those strategic changes of direction. You mentioned following the money. You mentioned seeing the writing on the wall at various times. I guess there are lots of good examples of where you've been central to a shift or maybe a redefinition of what the corporate strategy is for NTR.
Well, I guess if you look back, we first invested in renewable energy 26 years ago. We invested in a company called Airtricity in 1999. It was more straightforward back then in many ways, and in many ways it wasn't, because people were like going, what's this wind farm business that sounds high risk? Whereas over the course of the years that gone by, I think it's more accepted now that, you know, it's not really a technological risk there when it comes to it. The strategy, we've changed in three main ways, and I suppose the way I'd categorize them is, first of all, we changed markets. So pretty much a lot of what we did was in the US back 10 years ago, 10 to 15 years ago. Pretty much everything we had was in the US. We completely exited that market because it was very uncertain policy change at the time. When I was out there, I was working in our wind company out in St. Louis, and at the time, you never know from one year to the next what the US government policy would be to support renewables. And we found that a lot of the economics, they didn't really support NTR as an equity investor in these wind farms. It was supporting the tax equity investors, the bigger giants who were getting tax benefits, but we weren't getting those. So we're putting an awful lot of effort and work in, and we weren't really making that much money. So first strategic change was we pulled back into Europe. Europe's our back garden. We know it very well. There was a series of very stable subsidies across the European markets to support renewables, and we just took advantage of that. So back into Europe was the first change. The second change was we changed investment approach. We used to, as this conglomerate, invest 100% our own balance sheet. And we decided from a risk-reward perspective, we wouldn't solely be the only investor in every project, that we would share the investment with other parties. So we actually never set out to be fund managers, and we set out to raise capital to come in alongside ours to diversify the risk away from our own capital. So we'd have lots more investments, and if anything went wrong, then, you know, the loss would be limited to that particular investment. So that's the second change. We co-invest with these institutional capital investors. And the third, I suppose, is the sector itself changed. So 10 years ago, when we kicked off the strategy, I mentioned it was government supports and government subsidies. Today, for the most part, a lot of that is gone. Technology cost has come down for wind and solar and battery storage. They can stand on their own 2 feet or with the support of private capital. And by that, I mean a private company or public company, indeed, power purchase agreements with our renewable assets. So, you know, the big tech giants have them. So you're doing it outside of government supports, basically. So it stands on its own 2 feet. So that changed my job entirely, because the revenue offtake for how we get paid for building these wind farms completely changed, and we had to come up with a different way of doing it when the subsidies started to disappear.
Wow, a lot of changes there. St. Louis, I know very well. I'm sure the arch catches an awful lot of wind. Some of those changes, for example, moving out of the US, and some of the other changes you mentioned as well there, and almost accidentally becoming a fund manager. That's change, isn't it? That's changed not only for the corporate direction on a piece of paper, but it's changed to the workforce. It's changed to investors and other stakeholders as well. I'm curious as to what role, A, you've played in shaping those directions, and you've spoken to that. But here I'm interested in the role that managing that change, communicating that change, particularly when it does have such fundamental implications on the direction of the business. What role you play in managing the relationships, in managing that change, in communicating that change to the workforce and to investors?
It was an evolution, really, and we grew with it. When we restructured the business, we were down to about 10 people. So we were a very, very small team.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. We're a very small team, which is why, you know, you learn that being good at doing a bit of everything.
Yeah.
So in 2015, when we launched the first fund, we were about 10 people. Now we grew since then, but it was a evolution. That first fund was just a wind fund only, and it was UK and Ireland. We kept it very local. So we're in Ireland, UK's only across the water. And yeah, we're a small team. So it was construction. It was 12 construction assets. So we bought fields, we built the wind farms on them, and we've been operating them ever since. So that was our first fund strategy. Then we evolved from there. We added European assets, and we added solar, we added battery storage. So for that, we needed people living and working in Europe on our team. So we had to hire them. And we also broadened our investor base. Our investor base for the first fund was UK and Irish. Second fund was a much broader European investor base, attracted by the broader spread of the assets. And then our third fund, similar to our second fund, actually, because it worked very well. Again, broad European fund. We added offshore wind, though, into this third fund, which is in conjunction with Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General have been a cornerstone investor in all of our funds, in our three funds. But for the third fund, again, we changed tack and sort of marketing this bigger fund ourselves. We partner it with Legal & General Investment Management, LGIM. They're one of the world's largest investment managers. They've got 1.3 trillion under management. So take advantage of their expertise there.
So with regards to managing those three funds, your role as CFO, you mentioned Legal & General Investment Management there as being a huge stakeholder in that third fund. On a kind of day-to-day basis, once the fund is up and running, those first two and now the third one, what does your role in managing those entailing? Is that, I guess, there's ongoing relationships with investors and reporting and so on?
Very important to nurture and manage your investors and give them what they want, because their requirements are changing as well, because they've got, you know, the regulatory sustainability reporting, which is a huge area, which wasn't there when we originally started, but, you know, making sure that they have what they need on everything, not just the sustainability side. But it's also the acquisitions. I'm heavily involved on the acquisitions. We've done over 30 acquisitions since 2015. I sit on our management committee. So that's our CEO, myself, our chief investment officer, and our asset management director. So us four review every single proposed acquisition. And, you know, most of them don't make it, but the ones that do are all reviewed by us. My role of that team is on the risk side, commercial side. Does it make sense? The returns, are they good enough to compensate us for the risk of the asset? Then the debt. We've typically about leverage about 50% into our investments. So all of that has to be raised in conjunction with the investment team and then managed thereafter. And you report to these banks, mostly European banks, every 6 months. So managing the assets, managing the banks, and then finally, I was managing the team and building the company. I think 1 year I did 35 interviews. We've grown from those 10 people originally to over 50 people today. And we're in Ireland, the UK, we're France, Spain, we're in Sweden. We're in a lot of different markets and with a great culture. So fostering the culture and growing the culture and our values of decency, excellence and care.
I'm curious, Marie, right at the beginning, I asked you about the company's mission, if you like, NTR's mission. Do you have a mission yourself in how you operate? I mean, you mentioned there about the culture of the organization. Do you go down as far as, okay, so in my role as a CFO or COO, this is my mission, or does it all kind of cascade from what the overall corporate mission is?
I think I would have my own personal mission, actually. I think everyone should enjoy what they do. I think life's too short. I like people to be happy in their roles and in their work, feel like they're doing something good, producing great work with very high standards of excellence here in NTR. I've always promoted it right back from my Anderson's days. You know, exceed expectations every day was our motto back in Anderson. So I think, you know, do good work for a good. And I mean, we're fortunate that we work in the sector that we work in, and that, you know, our mission is, you know, climate change. Couldn't be a more worthy mission or more better place to work in the times that we live in.
I think that's a mission I could get behind as well. You mentioned a moment ago about the changing landscape with regards to funding, government support, something I just want to delve into a little bit. In the UK, where I'm based, in 2023, the government offshore wind auctions had a lot of coverage over the years. It saw zero bids tabled, and work also stalled on quite a big project off of the Norfolk coasts, with spiralling costs cited as the reason behind that. And again, there are lots of reasons for why the costs were spiralling that we know all too well. I'm just wondering what your take is on the broader picture regarding the appetite for investment in energy transition projects, not only in the UK, but you mentioned the number of different markets across Western Europe, across the Nordics that you operate in there as well. What is your view on how hungry investors are to invest in this area right now, given, I don't know, assessments of risk and so on?
It's very positive. I mean, you're right, that auction round five was very disappointing for the UK offshore wind, or for the UK government. But the strike price was £44. It was too low to build anything with the rising costs. There's been another auction since then, auction round six, and the strike price there has gone up 66% to £73. Results are due in September, but that should have a far more positive outcome. On top of that, Keir Starmer's new Labour government is boosting the support for offshore wind. He's added another £500 million, bringing the total budget for offshore wind up to £1.5 billion recently. And for onshore wind, the government have recently effectively removed, in July, I think it was, the de facto offshore wind ban, and they're looking to double the amount of onshore wind between now and 2030. So that's enormous. The Vattenfall project that you mentioned that stalled was actually sold to RWE, and that has just recommenced construction. Wider European view, looking at the other markets, Germany and the Netherlands have recently both issued results at their latest offshore wind auction, and that they awarded a combined, I think it was over 6 gigawatts between Germany and the Netherlands. To put that in context, the European market today has 19 gigawatts. So it was 6.5 on top of the 19 that currently exists today. So that's a step change once that all gets built out. In France, there's been recent onshore wind auctions that awarded nearly 1 gig of capacity. And that was oversubscribed. There was 1.8 gig of proposals submitted. They're launching two more offshore wind auctions in 2024. So look, I could keep going market by market. Generally, despite all the macroeconomic, geopolitical, we've had huge supply chain issues as well in the last 2 years. But the global investments into renewables in 2023, it totaled $1.8 trillion. That was a 17% increase on the prior year, 2022. And that needs to get to $4.5 trillion a year by the early 2020s to meet the Paris Agreement 2050 zero target.
That's really interesting to hear. And obviously, I'm based in the UK, so I've got a bit of a view there. It's interesting to hear what the view is like around other parts of Europe as well. And that all sounds very positive. In terms of investment, in terms of funding, you mentioned how certain government subsidies have maybe fallen off over the last few years, given that the role of private investment, there's been a lot more optimism there. Is that all, I guess, is this all good? Do we need more investment? Do we need more public investment as well as the private investment? Is it inevitable that the public investment will fall off as private takes up the slack?
I think governments and public investment is an important part of the factor. It won't ever go away. But I think private capital needs to flood in to fill this gap. I think the most important role that public and government can play is in terms of policy, in terms of ensuring that these assets can get planning permission, can get connected to the grid, that the infrastructure, the policy around the broader infrastructure. It's all very well building wind and solar farms, but if you build too many, the grid has to be able to cope with them. So the grid infrastructure needs to be strengthened, not just in the UK, but across Europe. A lot of capital to flow in there to be able to do that. But public policy needs to meet private money halfway to get that done in a timely fashion too. Yeah, again, back to risk reward. Private capital won't invest if there's too much risk there, if there's too much risk that the government policy won't back it, or won't back it quickly enough, or if policy won't support it.
I know a couple of days ago, as we record with my energy provider, it was a particularly windy day in the middle of England, and they were essentially paying us between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, please turn on all your devices, charge your car, turn on the tumble dryer. We won't charge you any more than your average usage for that hour slot, because hey, you know, I think there's a lot of, from the consumer point of view, and I'm sure from the infrastructure point of view, we're starting to see more innovation in actual products now, which I think is engaging members of the public, those of us who don't work in the industry. It's engaging us in ways we've never really been engaged in before, which I find particularly exciting. Just going back to the regulatory piece or to the government piece, it's a really dynamic space all the way across Europe, isn't it? We're seeing at the moment in particular changes of governments, evolving industrial strategies, new sustainability and environmental policies and so on. I guess, how on earth do you keep across all of that dynamism in this industry across the markets that you operate in? And how do you manage the risk that this dynamism, I guess many of these policies are outside of NTR's hands, yet they could have quite profound impacts on how NTR operates?
It's we've had it right from the start, but it's a very basic concept. But basically, is you maintain concentration limits in your investments. So market, you know, not too heavy into any one single market in case anything changes. Technology, again, you mix it up with offshore wind, onshore wind, solar, battery storage, mix it up in the different markets again. So you have a lot of diversification. And finally, the stage of life. So you have a lot more risks in an early stage development asset that hasn't yet got its planning or its land or its grading. You know, a government policy might change something that would delay or even stop that versus an operational project that's already up and running. Governments typically don't like to mess with assets that are already up and running because the capital's already in and there would be a backlash. So basically, concentration limits and make sure you're in lots of different markets with lots of different asset classes at lots of different estates.
Before we wrap up today, Marie, I'd like to chat about a part of your work that is, well, I guess sort of bigger than NTR, but also linked to it. Alongside you at NTR is a female CEO, Roisin Magukian, and I know how ensuring diversity, gender equality across NTR's business is important to you. And with that in mind, you are NTR's representative at the 30% Club. Tell us what 30% Club is and what a difference it, well, hopes to make, is indeed making.
So 30% Club is a campaign. It aims to increase gender diversity at board and exec committee levels. And the goal, by its name, is to have 30% representation of women on all boards and C-suites globally. It's established in the UK in 2010 and in Ireland in 2015. So it operates different chapters all over the world. It's got three main missions. One is to raise awareness of the benefits of gender balance at board and C-suite. Secondly, is to help companies achieve that gender balance. And third, improve the pipeline coming through. So promote mentoring programs, scholarships and leadership and training. In Ireland specifically, since its inception 10 years ago, the percentage of women on boards in Ireland has increased from 12% to 39% for the ISEC 20 and 28% for other listed companies. More work to be done on private companies, but it's getting there and it's having a huge impact, backed by the largest companies in Ireland and indeed in the UK. And it's making a difference.
And as far as NTR is concerned, mentioned there that your CEO is a female CEO as well. How has being a female-led company shaped what NTR is and how it does what it does, do you think?
Yeah, I don't think female-led would be a factor in our success per se. I don't think we kind of go, oh, we're female-led. We just sort of get on with it. When we started in NTR, you know, 20 years ago, it was very much an engineering company, so it was quite male. But again, there's always been a very open culture here. Our major shareholder, our former chairman would say, you know, he's got a family of four and two are male and two are female. So he's always liked to have a balance in the company as well. So culture really comes back as far as the shareholder, but it's not to, you know, overbalance one way versus the other. One of the challenges we would have had over the years is actually trying to get females into our engineering team, our construction team, our operations team, the engineering team. Just wasn't talent coming through there. So we've been very cognizant to try and make sure we have a good mix in there. You do get a very different perspective from females on the team, particularly in that sort of male-dominated engineering world. And we've had, you know, with a couple of female leaders coming through on the mid-level side as well, which is great to see.
How about from the finance position point of view? Do you feel as though there's a healthy pipeline, and what kind of stuff can you do to ensure that that pipeline continues to, say, ensure diversity?
I do. Across the company, not just the finance team, we're very open in terms of, people need to leave to attend nativity plays or pick up their kids. We're quite flexible in terms of how we manage time and our day. Since COVID, we've moved to a 3-day in the office week and 2 days at home, which I think has been beneficial as well with a view to retaining, particularly new parents of either male or female, actually, because there can be a lot of pressure on it. We've introduced paternity leave, paid paternity leave, or more recently we introduced fertility leave actually as well. So we're always like to think we're thinking one step ahead to make sure that we're the type of place people like to work. And people do stick with us. I mean, I'm here over 20 years. I'm not the only one. And there's other people in the company that have a very long tenure here. I feel we're a nice and a place to grow professionally as well as personally.
Finally, Marie, a question that we ask every guest on CFO Playbook. What does liberating finance mean to them? And by liberating finance, how might it help us all to accomplish more? So what does liberate finance mean to you, Marie?
Well, I think bringing it back to the funding gap that I mentioned, the trillions of funding gap to meet our 2030 and 2050 climate targets. There's a new type of investment structure called an LTAF or an LTIF. It means long-term asset or investment fund. They're about to liberate a whole new source of finance to liberate not only the energy transition in my space, but also other non-traditional investments and disruptive areas like fintech, life sciences, artificial intelligence. What they do is they allow retail investors, the man on the street, via their defined contribution pension schemes, access to illiquid or long-term private market investments like renewables. Traditionally, that's a kind of an illiquid asset class. Once your money goes in, it's in for 20 or 30 years, and they're only available to institutional investors due to their complexity, their size, their long-term nature. But the new structures, these LTAFs, they can give access to defined clients, and they manage the liquidity for those investors. So those private then investors, they're investing in these long-term assets in their portfolio. They get better diversification than they would if they were just in the public markets, reduces volatility. They know that they're investing in climate change and they can make very good returns. And for us, for NTR and companies like us, it means we have a source of fresh new capital. So these are new structures, but they're rapidly gaining momentum. It will liberate a whole new source of finance, we hope, for my sector, and address the huge gap that exists between the current finance flows and the estimates and sums that are needed to achieve net zero by 2050.
That certainly would be liberating finance. And like you say, it would enable you and other companies like you to do more, accomplish more. And, well, maybe the investors themselves might be able to accomplish more as well. Thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. And thank you so much for your insights today on your role in this what is a fascinating space. Marie Joyce, thank you so much for joining us on CFO Playbook Podcast.
Thanks, David.